These lectures are going to be fewer than I used to. So you have lecture notes, I think. I'm going to sort of try to select some combination of lectures which can reasonably get you to the spectrum of the bosonic string theory. In particular, I'm going to cut the first lecture, which was a lot of words about string theory, which at the end you can just read. And were of limited interactivity anyway. So the objective of today's lecture will be to understand how to quantize a string, a relativistic string, moving in space-time, which, and perhaps we should say before even quantizing, we should understand what relativistic string looks like. Here, string just means the analog of a particle in one-dimensional Higger. You know, a particle is something that moves along a line in space-time. A string is something that moves along a two-dimensional subspace of space-time. Who remembers what's the action of a relativistic particle?
Interval of the proper time.
Okay. So how do I write the proper time in terms of the history of the particle or whatever the particle is doing in space-time? Put the mass in front.
The square root of eta nu.
Okay.
Dx.
Yeah.
With respect to a parameter.
With respect to what?
A parameter lambda. Or?
Okay. Let's call it. Tau for now. Very good. Okay. This is an action which has some fun features. One interesting feature is that we picked a parameter along our trajectory, which has no physical meaning at all. We just needed to talk about the curve. We will find some way to talk about a curve. We picked a parameter along the curve. So this x of tau is literally a map from the real line to space-time. Right? We should say minus 1, 1, whatever. But we only care about the image of this map, not about the map itself. Indeed, this action has the funny property that it does not change if you redefine your parameter. So if I decide to write some new tau, which is some function of my tau, well, dx over d tau is dx over d tau tilde times d tau tilde over the tau, right? I'd show these factors here, one from here, one from here. Then there is a square root, so I got only one of them. And that cancels against the Jacobian for the change of coordinates. So this action is a function of this map. But it only really depends on the image. Now, how would you quantize something like that? Right. We would like, in principle, to write a path integral. E to the S. Oh, just SP. Right. But the action, I mean, the path integrals we really know how to make sense to are Gaussian path integrals, so things that look like a Gaussian path integral. Pretty much because these symbols don't really make much sense in this isolation. just a formal thing. And it's only the combination of something like this with a Gaussian measure or or path integral, Gaussian action, that is something we know how to make sense of. So here, we're already pretty much stuck. Now, it feels a bit crazy to be stuck because we're trying to quantize a particle moving freely in space-time with the quantum field theory of the time, so we should be able to do that. Of course, when you do quantum field theory, you use fields precisely because working with individual particles is annoying. But when we study string theory, the analog of field theory for strings is really difficult. And so we need to be a bit more familiar with things analogous to working with particles. And even, you know, even classically, how do you solve this? How do you study this problem, right? It's kind of unpleasant. The equations of motions look like something like this. Dx mu over d tau, 1 over square root of this blah, blah, blah. D over d tau equal to 0. So OK, if you start trying to solve them, you would write, OK, dx mu over d tau, 1 over square root equal to some constant. But then how do you proceed?
Usually, you set the normalization
equals
1 is
the H-fixing of a sort. Right. Usually, you say, well, I could pick any parameter I want. Let me just pick a convenient one where the square root is 1. So this is the actual proper time. And then this becomes simple. I just get rid of it, and I solve my problem. Actually, you could argue that setting it to 1 is a little bit too enthusiastic, because when I pick my parameterization, say that I was trying to find a solution between 2 points. I kind of had to say that my parameter ran from some, maybe from 0 to 1. But there's no way to guarantee that. But then that the proper length will actually be the integral of 1 from 0 to 1, which is 1. The proper length will be something else. So strictly speaking, what I should put here would put some constant here. And then I would perhaps get a 1 over, put an e here. And I would solve my equations with this. The equations are now perfectly beautiful, right? Once I set this to a constant, these are three, you know, the simplest free equation, right? Second derivative of something equal to 0. Magically, everything became nice. The only little annoyance is that there is e, which is some constant which you need to find at the very end. Like, we solve the problem, we find that, you know, x mu is u e u tau plus plus x0. And then we realized that this was the proper time that it took to go from here to here. So it's some function of x, you know, of the initial and final positions. So this complicated nonlinear problem became the combination of a familiar variational problem, which is this sort of simple second order differential equation, together with a little auxiliary one, you know, finite dimension, auxiliary problem of finding the correct E. And actually, let me show you a way to get here, which is a bit nicer. and we generalize to the case of strings. So one possible perspective is to rewrite this in a more convenient form by introducing some auxiliary degrees of freedom that we'll get rid of later on. By the way, yeah, okay, fine. It's not waste time. So what you can do is the following. Consider this action, which is a function of 2 degrees of freedom, x of tau and e of tau. I'll just use Einstein notation to speed things up a little. And I hope my writing is sufficiently clear. I'm not winning any calligraphy contests. Okay. So look at this action. This action is now quadratic in the axis. That makes us happier. But it's still non-polynomial because I had to insert an e and an e inverse, which is in this new variable. If you stare at this action, you can think about e squared as a metric on the line. Yeah, if I was to call this g, I could have called this square root of g, and this would be sort of like if I say that e squared is g tau tau, what do we call it? Tau tau. Then this would be sort of like square root of h. Right, and this will be square root of h tau tau. So you can think about this as an auxiliary metric on your R. And if I solve the equations of motion for E, I get something like E squared is dx. Mu over the tau, dx mu over the tau. And then I can plug it back in and get the original action. Now, I still have reparametrization invariance here. It now acts, I want this to be sort of invariant, which means I need to sort of say that e of tau d tau is equal to e tilde of tau tilde d tau tilde. So it transforms by a Jacobian when you change parametrization. And now this sort of gauge fixing can be done just by saying that E of tau is 1, or perhaps better again, I should call it L. So setting it to some constant. And then after I do this, this is perfectly nice quadratic action, which gives me this nice equations of motion. And the only thing that is left of the original E when I gauge fix it away is the equations of motion for E themselves, which impose the constraint that this thing squared is equal to some constant, which will have to be determined. Okay. So and once things are written in this form and gauge fixed, it's now pretty straightforward to quantize because now the path integral makes sense. I could say that I have a path integral over dx mu of e to the integral of dx over the tau squared L plus L inverse plus M squared L. And then I still need to sort of impose this constraint that x dot squared is equal to L squared. But I can do it in a natural way by integrating also over L. I mean, and you can think this as sort of doing the path integral over the x's and the e's, but throwing away the coordinate transformations, this gauge symmetry, which was changing the coordinate tau to some other coordinate.
So the amount of page freedom we have for the action of introducing some variable,
yes,
is only of the form e of tau d tau equals that equation.
Mm-hmm. And also, right, I should have written also this.
But it's not any element of the diffeomorphism to physics. It's only one.
Well, tau goes to a function of tau is the diffeomorphism group in one dimension. I didn't mean the diffeomorphisms of space-time. I just meant the reparametrization on my word line.
Maybe one question. So, what is okay? We have that action. We got the equations of motion, which could be simplified under this condition.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, okay, we can somehow encode the information of the simplification. I thought we were going to introduce this new gauge field as some sort of Lagrange multiplier.
Which gauge field?
Sorry, not gauge field, the E field.
Yes.
As a sort of Lagrange multiplier. But well, first question: is this equation gauge fixed already? This action? No.
No. This is action in X and E.
Exactly.
And also, I wouldn't call E a Lagrange multiplier because it doesn't appear linearly.
Exactly. It's not exactly. That made me change my stance on that.
That is a degree of freedom.
An extra degree of freedom that when you integrate out, you get back the original.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and we gauge fixed by setting it equal to a constant.
Yes. So, all right. So, an interesting feature of this action, of course, I could have gauge fixed in different ways, right? I could have said, I set tau equal to time. Why not? Then this would have been square root of 1 plus the x plus space, right? Then I could have sort of expanded it out in powers of this, and I would have gotten the non-relativistic action plus corrections. But it's ugly because it breaks Lorentz symmetry, right? And also it's definitely not free. So if I studied the problem like this, I would have studied relativities as a deformation of non-relativistic physics. But the equation of motion would not have been linear at all. It would have looked really, really ugly. And I would have had to work very, very hard to find that the actual solutions are very, very easy. So here we added this extra variable, which had a true nice effect of making the action in x quadratic, and also nice feature that I could essentially throw it away by cancel it out against gauge symmetry, against reparametrization invariant in a very straightforward way. I would essentially only throw away all of E except for its zero mode, for this constant mode. And so when I then do the quantum mechanics, I can just integrate over the constant mode instead of integrating over all the possible functional forms of E. Now, you could ask, is this anything I know? It looks still really weird. But it's actually something we can compute. This kind of path integral you've seen all the time doing just quantum mechanics. This is the quantum mechanics, but integral formally, except that the time is included in the directions of space-time. So if you do this path integral, you get something like this. X initial minus x final squared over 4L minus L m squared. So if you do the path integral over x, you get something like this. I know you must have seen the gain function in quantum mechanics at some point. OK. Now we need to do the integral over L. I'm going to use another little trick, which is to do the Fourier transform. Don't sweat the factors of 2 or 4 or 4 pi or whatever. I'm forgetting them anyway. Maybe those are true here. I don't know. Maybe not. I forget. Whatever. This integral were from 0 to infinity. But this is just the Fourier transform of the propagator. So this thing is just literally what you would have called the Green's function of a theory of a free scalar. So in quantum field theory, in the quantum field theory we've been studying until now, in order to study a theory of particles, you would introduce a field, say a scalar field. And you would say, OK, to study a process where I place a particle here and it propagates, and I annihilate it there, I will put a field here and another field here. And I would just compute the correlation function on the vacuum of phi, the two-point function, so it's called the Green's function. Right, acting on the vacuum, the field would create a particle at this position, then the particle would do its own thing, and then I would destroy the particle to get back the vacuum. And this is precisely the same as this. Right? It's the Fourier transform of the inverse propagator, which is 1 over of the propagator, which is this. So this beautiful quantum field theory answer, which you derive by studying fields without ever talking about particles, can be reproduced with a little bit of work from a path integral for a relativistic particle. It's a bit of a slog, and it has a lot of subtleties. You need to introduce this gauge symmetry by different morphisms. You need to gauge fix it. If you really want to do it properly, you would even use ghosts and all of that machinery. But at the end of this hard work, you do get to the familiar answers from quantum field theory. Now, do you have any questions? Surely do. So I would like to hear some of them.
So just to make sure I understand, the integral, the path, really what we should be doing is we should be integrating, because we've introduced the auxiliary field.
Yes.
We're doing two path integrals.
Yes.
Over x and over e.
Yes.
Because we have this reparameterization freedom.
Yes.
Once we divide by the that symmetry.
Yes.
Really what we're left with is just one dimensional integral over d.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's right. And of course, you could totally complain, well, I don't really know how to do the path integral over e because the action for e has no kinetic term and appears in this weird way here. And so you could say, OK, well, this is really how I define it. I gauge fix, and then I define it. which is something you already done, because when you did QED, you had to do a path integral over the gauge fields. The path integral didn't quite make sense because the kinetic term was, not a bit degenerate. And you had this gauge freedom that gave an infinite overcounting if you were not careful. So to do the path integral over the gauge field, you need to gauge fix somehow. And you probably saw various ways of gauge fixing. You could Coulomb gauge or Lorentz gauge or Bieresti quantization if you do it properly. But yes. So in general, when you have these gauge freedoms, the way you define things is you gauge fix to find a meaningful path integral. And then you need to work hard sometimes to show that different gauge fixings are equivalent, or that some symmetries you might have broken are restored. For example, if I go the non-relativistic way, showing that the final answer will have relativistic symmetry is going to be a pain. Mm-hmm. And the fact that classically you had it does not mean that it's going to still be there quantum mechanically. Because this word that we use, quantization, that goes from a classical system to a quantum system, it's an art, and it's magic, and it's not canonical. It's indeed, this is the first manifestation of anomalies. There is no way to take a classical system and quantize it while preserving all its symmetries.
I have a question.
Yes.
We usually fix the gauge by introducing new terms.
Mm-hmm.
FD, but here, I guess, we just fix some E to do some constant value L and did the path integrals. So, like, for example, we need some ghost terms to fix the gauge.
Right. So, when you do Bieresti quantization, this dividing by diffeomorphisms is done properly by introducing ghosts. Mm-hmm. I will probably not be able to go over the lecture on ghosts.
Wanted to know why this calculation works, because you just...
I mean, in when you do QED, you could work in an axial gauge where you set A3 to 0 or whatever, without adding any terms to the action. You just go through and impose the Coulomb impose a constraint analogous to this. A nice feature of this sort of extra constraints is that once you impose them at the beginning, they remain true. So there was the property that if you take the derivative of it, you get 0. So, for example, in this setting, when you study, say, a Feynman diagram or some more complicated process, you will force your particles that are coming in to be on shell, meaning they will satisfy a constraint, the p square, which is pretty much p squared equal to e squared, m squared. Okay, sorry, I'll get back to this better in a moment. Mm-hmm.
Do we have to think, you said that it's like the metric on the line, so we would think it like similarly to what we studied in relativity and like Jimmy and Newt, the normal metric, and we have a diffeomorphism invariant.
Yes.
But we are doing like a gauge theory, so like E is not at all like A mu, like a one form.
It's like Jimmy Newt.
And why does this not work for Jimmy and Newt? Like we cannot do this for relativity.
Oh, right. Yes, very good question, which will become crucial in 5 minutes. So here, something magical happened, right? I had the metric E, or perhaps E squared, the tau squared. And I could use a diffeomorphism to set it to the tau tilde squared, to sort of set E to a constant. That's because I have 1 degree of freedom in the metric and 1 diffeomorphism. Now, in 4 dimensions, say, how many degrees of freedom do you have in the metric? 10, that's right. And how many diffeomorphisms you have?
Four,
that's right. So you cannot put your metric in a canonical form in four dimensions. Next, we're going to do strings. Strings are two-dimensional objects moving in space-time. So the analog of this is going to be a two-dimensional metric, which has 3 degrees of freedom. And there are 2 diffeomorphisms. So you might worry that I will not be able to repeat this analysis for the strings. But a miracle will happen, and it will be possible. Any other questions?
Maybe one. You made also a remark about how the constraint is set, it's compatible with the time evolution of the thing. It's preserved.
Yes, so d over d tau.
Yeah. So
of this is zero.
So that must be facilitating something. What is that? Is that creating, or what obstacles you could find if that were not the case?
Classically, all it means, in the classical setup, all it means that you solve this problem, you solve this equation, you solve the simpler equations, and then you just need to impose a constraint on the initial conditions, which is nice and kind of needed, because you know when you solve the equations of motion, at the end the whole trajectory is determined by the initial conditions. If I had to impose a constraint at each point of the trajectory, which changes at each point of the trajectory, then I'd be dead. It's going to be impossible to find a solution. So it had to be that this extra constraint only really constrains the initial data and or final data. And in electromagnetism, when you go in a gauge where I say A0 is zero, you get the constraint, which is like divergence of A is zero. Again, this constraint only needs to be imposed on the initial state, and then it will propagate and remain true. So if you have a photon, I don't know, like that, you impose this constraint. Anyway, so I wanted to do the analog of this for the for the relativistic string. So can you guess the action for the relativistic string? So as I said, the string is a 2D object propagating in space-time. So.
Suppose it would be now the integral over the surface, like the proper
So the case of freedom is going to be now some x mu, which is a function of two things. How do I call them here? Let me call them u1 and u2. Some coordinates on my string. So what action can I build out of this x? So again, I had to introduce some coordinates, which are not in order to talk about this thing. So I need to write down an action which does not depend on this choice. Okay, they are very good. So I put a number in front, I call it a tension. And then I need, what is the area? If you remember, I need to take a determinant of a 2x2 matrix, which is eta mu nu, dx mu over d ua, dx nu over d ub. U1, du2. Okay, somebody, yes?
Oh, I was going to ask, before you go ahead, would you mind giving us some motivation as to why it's very important to study, you know, higher dimensional objects rather than seeking inference?
Oh, I'm not going to. In the sense that at this point, I'm just trying something. It's very far from obvious that there will be any situation where it's useful to take one-dimensional objects as the two-dimensional objects as the elementary degrees of freedom. There are definitely situations in physics where I get two-dimensional objects emerge from some other dynamics. I can have vortices in some system or in some 2D system, or I can have confining strings in Yamil's theory. And you might totally want to try to. I mean, you could have a situation where yes, these strings are the most are sort of the things you see at low energy, and so you might want to see if you can quantize them. But in such a situation, you would typically have a macroscopic string, which is really stretched across your system, maybe it's between two quarks or whatnot. And you would probably try to do something like this. You would say, my string, it stretches along two directions, and it fluctuates a bit along the other directions. You would probably not be interested in a situation where the string is doing very weird, complicated things on a small scale, because this string will typically have a thickness. But OK, you might still try to do something with, try to quantize in a Lorentz invariant way this string. It's still a valuable exercise, which might give information on the quantum behavior of these extended objects. So in short, extended objects do occur, even in quantum field theory, maybe not as elementary degrees of freedom, but it's something that emerges at some scales. And it might make sense to see if I can just write a theory that describes these objects. Like an analog of an effective field theory, but which includes things which are not particles. A challenge is that, and I could do this for things of various dimensions, not just two. Now, this sort of problem that the action is not polynomial kills you in dimension greater than two. In dimension two, it doesn't, because of a miracle I'm going to discuss momentarily. So there is a nice feature which makes it possible to quantize strings in a manageable way. So can somebody tell me why is this parametrization invariant? What happens if I change my coordinates? Well, okay, you can say it's the area, so clearly it's parameterization invariant, and this will be a perfectly valid answer. In practice, do you see how it happens? What happens if I change my u coordinates?
The Jacobian of u1 and u2?
Yeah, you get the Jacobian here and a Jacobian here. So this matrix is multiplied by the Jacobian on both sides, but I'm taking the determinant. So that gives me the determinant of Jacobian squared. I take the square root, I get the Jacobian. It cancels against the transformation of the measure. OK. Now, in order to deal with this non-polynomial action, we'll use a trick which is analogous to this, to go from here to the action as a function of E. So what you do is to consider a different action. It's called the Polyakov action. You just couple these fields to a two-dimensional metric. So Okay. So it just so happens that if I do the if I write down the equations of motion for h, and I integrate away h, I go back here. And this action is quadratic in the x's. And this is, again, badly non-polynomial in h. So this hab is going to play the same role as e squared was playing on the other blackboards.
Wait, sorry, would you mind reminding us what the t is? Is it like an
L? Yes, t is a number.
Okay.
It's a scale, really, because this. Here, this is the dimension of a length, so I needed to multiply it by an inverse length. And here, this is the dimension of a length squared, actually. And so I need to multiply by this inverse, by some number.
A reason that we gave in classical physics to write the second axiom,
yes,
so that we would be able to write the axiom for a particle with mass equals zero. But here, the t is in front of everything, not like in the second axiom that we wrote, we have like.
Yeah, that's right. Peculiar feature here that, but right. Of course, I could have also absorbed m, rescale e by m, in which case m would have been in front of everything. But it's true that here I don't need a cosmological constant term, something like square root of h. So here I end up having both an h contracted with x's and also a square root of h. Here I don't. It's a nice first nice feature of 2D. That if you have the variation of just this action, you go back here. It's an exercise. You probably do it in the tutorial. I have no idea if it's going to, but it's just algebra. You need to learn how to do things like varying the inverse metric with respect to the metric. Or vary the square root of the determinant of h with respect to the metric. But these are simple calculations. Take it, you know, this is just h inverse, and this h. You get something like h, a, b, a, c, h, b, d, or something like that, plus. Symmetrized. And similarly, there's a nice expression for this. So just pretty straightforward. You can write the action for h, the equation of motion for h, and plug them back to get here. Essentially, the equation of motion for h tell you that h is the induced metric from the space, from space-time. Okay, and now we need to gauge fix. So we want to find the form of h, which will make the equations of motion for x simple, and that will fix the diffeomorphism invariance. And now there is a nice fact about two-dimensional geometry, rather not obvious. You can always find coordinates locally such that the metric can be written as a multiple of the diagonal. You cannot bring it to just a constant. You cannot bring it to be one, but you can bring it to a multiple of the diagonal. So I had 3 degrees of freedom. I used 2 diffeomorphisms to just get one. Okay? And then you can plug this in here. And the magic happens. The magic is that phi drops out. So the inverse metric is an e to the minus phi. And the determinant of the metric is an e to the phi, and the two cancel. So I can just solve the equations of motion for this action. This is a nice Laplacian of x equal to 0. And I just need to impose the constraint, which is the equations of motion for the metric, which is, you might remember that the variation of the stress tensor with respect to the metric is called the stress tensor. Anyway, there is some object which is something like this. Minus trace. So the traceless part of this quantity is set to 0. These are the constraints. Yes?
I think I missed it when you said, how did you get that D squared? Oh, that's
sorry.
Class. Okay.
Sorry. So just to say it again, I start in this difficult action, right? The area. I want to solve the problem, what's the surface of a minimal area with some boundary conditions? No, shape of the soap bubble with no pressure inside. So this sounds like a difficult problem, right? Should be hard to solve. But I find that I can solve it by just solving a bunch of linear equations with just Laplacian of each coordinate, 2D Laplacian of each coordinate equal to 0, and impose a constraint. So this is already magic, meaning this is a fact about classical geometry, which is really beautiful, that I can solve the minimal area problem for a two-dimensional surface by solving linear equations and imposing a quadratic constraint. And I totally invite you to try to find some solutions to this, classical solutions to this problem, maybe even some boundary conditions, If I have shape like that, and I try to find the soap bubble attached to this frame. Can I do it like this? Yes.
Will the tension ever become relevant in a variation problem of sorts? Because if it's just a constant.
No, indeed, it's just in front of everything.
So when will we care about it, or
when you do the path integral, then it will be in front of the action, and so it will control your quantum effects. Now, it's a scale, which only really means it sets the scale above which the quantum effects become more important. OK, so we're almost done. We just need to understand the analog of this. So if you remember here, we could set locally E to be a constant, but which constant mattered? There was a sort of a diffeomorphism invariant quantity, which was the total length of this curve. And we are integrating essentially over that. So here I need to understand what's left of the information of the metric after I do this. So as I said, there's a theorem that locally you can do this, but not globally. So there is some information on that is associated to the whole surface, the same way as the length was associated to the line. There could be some information associated to the whole shape, which I'm not going to be able to see much locally, but could still be contained on how the different local patches are glued together. So this is the point where it becomes useful to introduce complex coordinates on the worksheet. So I'm going from this u1 u2 to u1 plus I u2, that I'm going to call z. If I do that, the statement becomes that the metric is e to the So the length element is something like e to the phi, the z bar. So why am I introducing these complex coordinates? Because in order to compare different ways of doing this operation, I will have to find coordinate transformations with the property that e to the phi the square u is equal to the e to the phi tilde the square u tilde. So I need to find what coordinate transformations are left after I fix things to be of this form. I fix the metric to be of this form. And it turns out that the coordinate transformation which allow you to do this, which for this is true, are simply coordinate transformation where z becomes a function of z tilde. An holomorphic function of z tilde. Because when I do this transformation, then the z becomes the z tilde times the derivative of that. Right, so e to the phi the z bar becomes e to the phi the z over the z tilde squared the z tilde bar. Sorry for having tilde bars. Should use primes. So I have this sort of picture. I have my worksheet, my surface. I have patches. In each patch, I can happily bring the metric to this form and find some coordinate, z, z prime, holomorphic coordinate, z double prime, z triple prime. And so I do it in this patch, somebody else does it in this patch, somebody else does it in this patch, right? When we compare nodes, we find that the coordinates we used might differ by a holomorphic coordinate transformation on the patch. So at the intersection, z prime will be some function of z. And not z bar, just z. An holomorphic function. In other words, the z bar, z prime, is zero. That's what holomorphic means.
Mm-hmm. In each of these patches, we are basically assuming that the metric is, in that patch, conformally flat.
No, that's not. See, the beauty of it is in two dimensions is not an assumption. The metric is always conformally flat in the correct coordinates.
And are we in two dimensions in the sense that we are looking at strings?
Yes.
In arbitrary dimensions?
Yeah, but when I talk about dimensions here, it's just the worksheet, the place where the string comes, you know, the support of the string itself. So I've covered my worksheet with patches, and each patch have an holomorphic coordinate, and have an holomorphic coordinate transformations. This is called the complex structure. So the final path integral will look like this. There will be the path integral over the axis with this beautiful simple action. And then I'll have to do an integral over the. We had to learn how to parameterize complex structures. I had to do an integral over complex structures. On the worksheet. And this will play the same role as this integral over the lengths that we had here. Mm-hmm.
Why is it that the coordinate transformations are holomorphic? What goes wrong if they depended on z bar?
If they depend on z bar, then this does not go to this. There will be the z tilde square term and the z bar tilde square terms.
Because we want an order of that.
Yes, that's right.
Which is real, right? I suppose that's also important.
It's automatically real.
Exactly. That's, so one way I was thinking about this is, just so if I'm right, so we had some gauge freedom in, what was I thinking? Yeah. And to impose constraints on the shape of our metric, and we were able to bring it to that form where it's simply a real constant of French times.
It's not a constant.
Sorry, a real function. Mm-hmm. And, but it's a, yeah. And then, okay, and the other claim is, well, on different patches we might look, we will look in this way, but it seems to me we're saying something like we still have some gauge degrees of freedom left, and those are equivalent to holomorphic functions that. Is that reasonable?
Those are the compact structure on the surface.
Yes, exactly. The even after imposing that constraint, we have some residual gauge freedom, and it turns out that residual gauge freedom is equivalent to a compact structure in some way. It's a holomorphic function
so,
of the patches.
I'm saying we're trying to build a gauge, you know, gauge invariant quantity. And which does not depend on how you put coordinates, local coordinates on your surface.
Yeah.
Now, it could have been the case that every two surfaces with the same topology and a complex structure placed on it could be related by holomorphic coordinate transformations. But it just happens not to be the case.
Okay.
So this is not an obvious statement that there is a non-trivial space of complex structures. Sorry, I want to say this. Let me step back for a second because. So, we want to sort of gauge fix the integral over the matrix. Okay, and we said if you divide by the diffeomorphisms, well, locally we can get rid of two degrees of freedom, and we're left with this phi. This phi actually does not matter for the path integral over the axis. So it actually doesn't enter the action at all. That should worry us. It's a problem. It's a problem. It means that when I do the path integral over h, I still be left with the integral over phi with no measure, no path integral, you know, no action, nothing. So definitely here I die unless I just throw away phi itself by hand. So meaning there is just a big infinite in front of the path integral, which is the volume of phi, the total integral of phi. I'm going to get rid of it. How do I get rid of it? I'm going to introduce a new symmetry called the Weyl symmetry. The Weyl symmetry takes the axon, the metric only, and rescales it. Okay. This action is clearly invariant under the Weyl symmetry because it doesn't depend on them. Because no, it's not obvious. But if I rescale h, this will rescale in one direction. This will rescale in the other direction, and the action will not change. So what I can do is to divide to treat the Weyl transformation as a gauge transformation. Divide both by the diffeomorphisms and Weyl transformations.
Only in two dimensions the action is.
Yes, absolutely. This is magic that happens only in two dimensions. And so the question is, what information is there in a metric after if I ignore both diffeomorphisms and Weyl transformations? Because of the Weyl transformations, I cannot do things like areas. Areas are definitely not going to be a gauge invariant quantity. Lengths are not going to be gauge invariant quantities. Now, ratios of lengths might be in a better shape. So the statement is that the gauge invariant quantity here is a way to put a complex structure on the manifold. So if I have a complex structure, I get a metric modulo Weyl transformations. not completely obvious, but I can sort of take the z, the z bar, and try to adjust something in front so that I can join things across patches. And conversely, if I have a metric, I get a complex structure because I can look locally for coordinates, such as this is true. And then across patches, the coordinate transformations will be holomorphic. So it's definitely true that sort of metric modulo diffeomorphism and vial has a relation to complex structures. Now, in order to make the relation more precise, I want to make sure I understand what it means for true manifolds to have a different complex structure. Right? So it really means that I cannot find an holomorphic coordinate transformation relating the two, pretty much. A priori, it's not obvious that there will be a nice space of complex structures, or that this will be a finite dimensional space. So it's non-trivial that it is non-empty, that is, you know, it's not obvious that it is a non-trivial space. It's also not obvious that it is a finite dimensional space that you can work with. And understanding the space of complex structures require a little bit of algebraic geometry that probably goes beyond what we usually learn up to this point. One way to think about this is the following. You could say, okay, let me see if I can change the complex structure. How would I do that? In each patch, I would have to sort of look for a different coordinate, change my coordinate a little bit by some amount which is not holomorphic, right? And then I can try to do the same in each patch. And then I could try to find if I can modify the gluing in such a way that it's still holomorphic in these new variables. So I would have to sort of change the Fs too. And so the problem becomes, okay, can I find, I have some delta Zs, can I find some delta Fs which are compatible with them? And this becomes a little bit of work becomes a cohomology problem. What's called the check cohomology problem, where you have some data in each patch and you're trying to find some ways to glue this data across the patches in a consistent way. And then using algebraic geometry, you can solve this cohomology problem and find that there are a certain number of complex structural deformations. But, you know, there is no point discussing this until we actually decide which shapes, which processes, which phenomena we want to look at with these strings. And here, probably, we should just start on the next lecture with that. But right, perhaps I can anticipate that the sort of thing you want to do is I'm studying closed strings, which are little loops of string. I have some closed strings coming from the past, and they do stuff, and they go out in the future. And you know, if I was to do particles, I would just do a finite diagram, right? Have the particles join and being created and destroyed. But with strings, I can do something nicer, which is just to add them smoothly. Propagate. And then the question is, what is the space of complex structures I can put on a blob like that? And well, we'll answer the question for three-level amplitudes, where the blob has no loops. And this will be more than enough for our purposes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I wanted to ask about the constraint equation.
Yes.
You said that it's like the stress energy tensor in 2D.
In 2D, that's right.
So, like, Like forcing it to be tracing?
Delta S over delta H. Now, we know that this is well invariant. So if delta H, if I change the metric by an amount proportional to the metric, this will vanish automatically. So this call is called TAB. Sorry for the symbol that is a bit. So the constraint is that this TAB, which I just wrote here, is 0.
You and you are contracted there, right?
Yes. Yes, sorry. And I subtracted the trace, so that it's traceless.
So we know that there is like no conformal anomaly.
Oh, I have not discussed that point at all. So it's true. I also had a path integral of the axis. And while symmetry acts on both, on the whole thing, and the whole procedure only works if this measure actually has Weyl invariance. Now, Weyl invariance is dangerous because it changes the scale. And when you renormalize path integrals, we put cutoffs. So it messes up your cutoff. So it could be broken quantum mechanically. And indeed, it typically is. So you get extra constraints from the requirement that Weyl symmetry is still there as a quantum mechanically as a symmetry. If you ask how this path, how this integration measure changes when you do a Weyl transformation, it changes by an amount proportional to the dimension minus 26. And so this procedure, quantum mechanical, makes sense only in 26 dimensions. This is why bosonic strings live in 26 dimensions.
I wanted to ask also very quickly, I don't know, like, why is it important that it's Weyl invariance and not conformal invariance? Or it doesn't matter?
So, conformal invariance is the notion of conformal invariance is something that makes sense in flat space. I'm given a metric which is already flat, and I'm looking for coordinate transformations which leave it flat up to scale. The notion of Weyl invariant is a notion defined for any with any metric. It's a theory which is invariant when I change the overall scale of the metric. So if a theory is Weyl invariant and I start with a flat metric, then I will have conformal symmetry. Because conformal transformations leave the metric flat up to Weyl transformations. So Weyl invariance is a way to talk about conformal symmetry in a generic metric.
And hammer the point home. So we said, okay, we had first this gauge symmetry, and we leveraged it to say that in two-dimensional manifolds, it can be made diagonal, the metric,
yes.
Leveraging that mm-hmm. symmetry. But then we found there's still this redundancy because our action is still symmetric under
mm-hmm.
Weyl transformations, which
yes.
is not the same subset of transformations as Diffeos.
Yes.
So we
added to the gauge symmetry, now we have the two.
Yes, exactly. And so we're concluding that the space of diagonal metrics up to Weyl transformations is somehow isomorphic in some sense to the space of complex structures.
Not the space of diagonal metrics, space of all metrics, modulo Weyl and
Diffeo
is the same as the space of complex structures.
Okay.
And is a five-dimensional space.
Okay.
In the same way as the space of all metrics on a segment modulo diffeomorphisms is one-dimensional, is the space of lengths. The only subtlety is that complex structures are a little bit of a more refined notion than the length of something. And
this depends only from two dimensions.
Yes, that's right. So in three dimensions, we would get stuck because there is no Weyl symmetry. And then we would still have degrees of freedom in the metric, local degrees of freedom. And then the path integral would just not be quadratic. Then all you could really do is to do sort of small fluctuations around something big, expanding this non-quadratic action into something like this. So you would do a small fluctuations with some interactions. So in a sense, on a membrane, if you send in some waves on the membrane, the waves will scatter from each other. And the magic is that on a two-dimensional object, the waves don't scatter from each other. I mean that the equations are linear. There's this quadratic constraint, which still are enough to give you some non-trivial, shapes.
When you spoke about the H, A, B, the wild transformation.
Yes.
You said we can treat this as an H transformation.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
So the action is invariant under wild transformations. So the patintera will just be meaningless unless we just quotient by them, simply because I have whole infinite dimensional configurations of fields which have the same action. And so when I integrate over them, I just get infinity to a very large infinite power. So we just add while symmetry as a gauge symmetry. We're just trying to define a path integral that makes sense. And this path integral has a chance to make sense, because if I change if I change x and h in ways that are not given by this, the action will vary, in a sense. So in particular, classically, for example, the equation of motion become elliptic once you gauge fix these symmetries, meaning that the solutions are determined by the values of the boundary.
But what happens in higher dimensions in non-two dimensions, when you don't have the wild
invariant? So it means that you can still do this.
Yes.
And it's fine. The action, though, is not polynomial in H. And so classically, it's going to be difficult to solve the equations because they're not going to be linear. And quantum mechanically, it's even worse. We will not know how to define the path integral because it's not quadratic. At best, we could do an expansion of some sort where there is a quadratic piece and then higher powers, and study small fluctuations around some configuration where the quadratic piece is non-trivial.